We're talking with a kidney bean processor and supplier here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. So family-owned Chippewa Valley Bean, headquartered in Menominee, describes itself as the largest processor and exporter of kidney beans in North America, exporting more than 70% of its product around the globe. But inconsistent rains have reduced this year's harvest. We'll get to that. What do you want to know about Wisconsin's kidney bean production and export business? It's 800-642-1234. Charles Walksmith is vice president of Chippewa Valley Bean. Charles, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me on.
Good morning. Give us some backstory, if you would. Tell us about how Chippewa Valley Bean got established, you know, growing and processing kidney beans in Wisconsin.
Well, I can reach way back on that. My maternal side of the family, that's the Doan side, settled in Dunn County in 1858. And they really were an all-around farm, row crops and animals up through when my grandfather, Russell Doan, planted his first crop of kidney beans in 1969. And at that point, they decided that they would like to then process the product that was growing on our farm. So in 1972 or 73, Chippewa Valley Bean was founded.
That first crop changed everything, changed the whole direction of the farm.
It did. You know, at that time, he was looking for something that would that he could do besides corn or soybeans, just because he felt that in West Central Wisconsin, we were not going to compete with, you know, the belt of Indiana, Illinois, Iowa, and places like that. So we needed a higher value crop for our area.
Are there climate challenges in growing kidney beans here?
Well, there are challenges in general with kidney beans. Like if you think about when you open up a can of kidney bean and pour it out, what you want to see is a solid field of that beautiful red mahogany color. And so if you see the interior of the meat of the bean, that means there's a cracked seed coat. And so the real challenge in kidney beans is harvesting to make sure you do not damage that beautiful seed. We're actually in a really good place in West Central Wisconsin and a little bit north through Minnesota in that our cool nights allow for a really good growing season for kidney beans.
It's fascinating that you say the uniformity of kidney beans, because when I look at kidney beans, when I make my chili, I think about how the beans are so uniform. They look alike. Not one is misshapen. Do you have like massive quality control, or are all kidney beans just naturally like that?
We do have massive quality control, but what you're seeing in the shape of that is just genetics.
Okay.
We do have multiple varieties that do have a slightly different shape from our, what we know as the traditional kidney shape to more of a capsule tube shape. Mm-hmm. But in the United States, the standard variety is what's called a Montcalm, and that does have that distinctive kidney shape.
So what states harvest the most dark red kidney beans?
Far and away it is in Minnesota, and we are actually, we joke around that we are in the worst place for a kidney bean processing facility. We're on the far eastern side of the growing area. Mm. Traditionally, they started growing them in New York and Michigan and California, and then really through the 70s and 80s, that production moved to Wisconsin and Minnesota. Now, Minnesota is far and away the largest growing region for kidney beans.
We're talking with Charles Walksmith about the kidney bean industry, a processing supplier based in Menominee. You can join in. Are you a kidney bean grower? What's the season been like for your crops? Have you noticed a change in production? Join in at 800-642-1234. So you export the vast majority of these beans, dozens of countries. How has the pandemic affected your ability to export?
Oh, it's been very difficult. You know, once everything locked down, people were really doing a lot of shopping from home, and that put a lot of stress on container movement around the world. Add to that truckers and things like that. Truckers getting sick, that meant there were less trucks going. It's been challenging. On the plus side, though, as you look at people being in lockdown and looking for nutritional, delicious, shelf-stable foods, kidney beans and beans in general were flying off the shelf. So we had a lot of orders that got moved forward, and people stocked their pantries.
I've talked with some small businesses before in other industries that are now very successful exporters of their goods who've told me that the U.S. Export-Import Bank has really helped them greatly in moving their product around the world and finding and getting established in different markets and lines of credit and so forth for foreign customers. Has that ever been the case for your company? How did you break into world markets?
Well, I'm going to give a shout out to the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture and DATCAP. They were really helpful getting our export business off the ground. We also work with the Midwest Food Exporters for help in grants and getting things like setting up for a show. We're at the largest food trade fair in the world this year at Anuga. I'm currently speaking to you from Cologne, Germany. But yeah, for small businesses, reach out to see what the state level has for you, because everybody wants to help you. The state really wants you to be successful. And I can't say enough about our DATCAP here in Wisconsin.
So can you tell us a little bit about where these kidney beans go once they leave you in Menominee?
Well, how do you want me to answer that? How they move, like, literally, or where they end up and what they do?
Yeah, I guess, you know, kind of let us follow the life of your kidney bean, if you will. Take us on this tour, on this road trip. Well, it might not be a road trip, though. You probably go by sea as well.
Well, let me go way back then. The majority of kidney bean seed comes from the western states, Idaho, places like that, because their arid growing conditions means less disease on the seed. We then distribute that to our farmers in Minnesota and Wisconsin who grow it and ship it to Chippewa Valley Bean. We process it. And at that point, the majority of our stuff gets put on a 20-foot container and taken up to the rail yard in Minneapolis. After that, it'll go east or west. The majority of our product goes out of the Port of Montreal and puts on a ship, makes it to its destination country, and then gets canned.
So it gets canned, you know, once it reaches its destination.
Yeah. We do not
that's
do
fascinating.
Any of that here in the United States. So if you think of canners in our area, you know, Wisconsin has a long history of canning vegetables, including beans. So you've got Seneca down in the Janesville area. Bush Brothers has a plant in Augusta, Wisconsin. And so the beans are soaked and sorted and then canned at these facilities.
The Trump administration had enacted tariffs on European products, and Europe responded with a 25% tariff on U.S. egg products. What impact have tariffs had on kidney beans?
The biggest, of course, is that my competitors around the world who grow kidney beans get 24% more value for their product. The impact is along the lines of United States agriculture, kidney bean farmers have not made as much money as what they should have. The world market is for kidney beans is at a certain level. And because of the tariffs, you know, we could have brought a lot more value back to the Midwest without them. It's been very difficult. And even if you look at the impact of in the United States, you know, these were steel and aluminum tariffs. And so if you raise the price of steel and aluminum, you also raise the price of canned goods here at home. So it's been a double impact. It's been an impact on our buyers in the EU, especially because they pay more for the beans, but it's also been an impact for our customers in the United States because they pay more for their cans.
There's that ripple effect.
It's huge. Even down to the line where we were looking to put up more storage so we could bring in more, you know, add on more growers and bring in more kidney beans. But with the price of steel, our capital improvement costs have went way up.
Charles Walksmith with us, Vice President at Chippewa Valley Bean, rapidly growing processor and distributor of kidney beans to dozens of markets around the world. Are you a kidney bean grower? What has it been like for you? Have you noticed changes in production? What do you want to know about the kidney bean industry? Be part of this 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Charles Walksmith here on the Ideas Network. We're We're learning about Wisconsin's kidney bean industry here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Chippewa Valley Bean is a global market leader in dark red kidney bean production based in Menominee. According to the USDA's dry bean market report published yesterday, dark red kidney bean prices remain steady at $44 to $49 per hundredweight. That's the standard unit of weight for this commodity. Charles Walksmith watches market prices closely, I would imagine, as vice president of Chippewa Valley Bean, with us for about 9 more minutes. Charles, do the market prices remain pretty steady, or are they prone to fluctuations?
Well, like any agricultural good, we do have fluctuations. Depending on the year, is it going to be a short crop or a long crop? We're also very dependent on what the world market does. With our friendly competitors to the north in Canada, or, you know, countries like Argentina grow a lot of beans too. If you're really interested, what we'll look at coming here soon is we do believe that we will see tariff relief within the next year or so. We've been closely talking to the U.S. Trade Representative Ambassador Tai, and there's an indication that those tariffs will go. And if that's the case, you're going to see a big spike as the Europeans really buy, and then you'll see it come back down. But yeah, it fluctuates, but it's always a good value to bring back to the grower.
Is there a dried bean futures market?
There is not. Okay. We are not big enough for that.
I was just curious.
There are a lot of kidney beans grown. There's a lot of beans grown in the Midwest, but we are the distant small stepchild or step cousin of, like, say, soybeans.
Chicago's not pounding on your door, right?
No, they're not. No.
All right. Well,
maybe the Des Moines Board of Trade or something like that.
Okay. All right. Let's talk about weather, kidney bean harvest, and drought. What have conditions been like for far southeastern and northwestern Wisconsin with little rain?
Well, what we saw this year is if you went out and looked at the kidney beans in early August, they were beautiful. You know, most of our kidney beans are growing on irrigated sands. They like dry feet, and they like to be, you know, they're high enough value product that you want to keep water on them. And so we were barely able to keep up on irrigation this year, and the plants looked wonderful until the harvesters started to get out there, and you would see these pods that were supposed to have 6 or 7 beans in them. But once you opened up the pod, there were 3 or 4. And that extreme heat we had caused the plant to cannibalize those seeds and put that energy back into the plant itself.
So what does that mean for your production if your farmers are just not able to supply you with the amount of beans that you typically need?
Well, you know, it's not like I'll explain a little bit of how this works. So we go out to our growers and we offer them a contract, and it is a per acre contract. And so the grower, it's usually 14 bags, 1400 weight per acre is what the contracted price is. So it's a full production contract. So the grower will then bring us their overage as well. So in Wisconsin, we usually see yields, 20 to 24 bags per acre.
Okay.
So then that grower has the option of pricing those extra 10 bags when they want to. So from a sales perspective, we only go out and sell those first 14 bags because that's what we know we're going to bring in.
Mm-hmm.
We don't go out and try and sell that overage until the crop's in the bin.
I see. We have a call in here. Couldn't stay with us. Shaney from New Richmond wants to know that if you sell dry beans, would that be a way to avoid the tariffs?
Nope. It's dry edible beans. So we ship the dry beans to Europe.
Mm-hmm.
It's too expensive really to ship a canned bean overseas because you're shipping all that weight in the water and the can itself. So no, these go out in big 1 metric ton totes.
So if there is a farmer that would want to plant kidney beans or to try out this crop, what would you say?
We're always excited to work with new growers. We're really making an effort to develop new growing regions in Wisconsin. We've got some great growers now over in the Central Sands area and that big vegetable and potato production area. And we're happy to help. You know, we're the only processor in Wisconsin. So if they gave us a call, our number is 715-664-8342. I'll have one of my agronomists speak to them. We're going to talk to them about their soil type and if they have irrigation and what they have for equipment. And then we'll do our best to make sure they're successful.
In terms of water, how much water does it take to grow kidney beans?
Well, that's very dependent on the weather.
Okay.
It's usually about 90 to 100 gallons, but you know, that depends on the year. The one metric we always use for this when we promote kidney beans is that it takes, you know, right around 100 gallons of water to produce a pound of kidney beans versus it takes about 1800 gallons of water to produce a pound of meat. So that's our beans.
A comparison. We're talking with Charles Walksmith, who works in the kidney bean processing industry. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Let's go to Louie in Oconto. Hi, Louie.
Yes, I have two questions, one about the weather and then one about, you were just talking about the tariffs that have been on for probably at least 3-4 years. Do you think the farmers have been voting differently because they've been so affected bottom line in their pocketbook with the tariffs? And second question, how does the Minnesota drought affect the kidney beans, or are they grown in a different area of Minnesota?
Thank you, Louis. So political and climate.
Okay, so the first one, you know, it's tough to say if people were switching their votes. I think some might have, but it seemed if you were a fan of the past administration, you were a fan of the past administration, and some tariffs probably didn't affect you that much. As for the Minnesota drought, we definitely saw impacts on those dry land beans. Those beans really suffered. But like I mentioned earlier, kidney beans are often grown, in fact, mainly grown under irrigation. And so there was some worry, I believe, that the Minnesota Department of Agriculture was going to put on some pumping limits. And if they had, that would have been bad.
You know, Charles, Wisconsin Economic Developers, and I know you mentioned the Ag Department, they're continually working to support the ag industry and lifting up rural communities so that they can stop those populations from shrinking. What would help you the most to keep thriving in Menominee?
Wow, that's a very big question right there. You know, we would like to see education keep moving forward. We're very lucky that in Menominee we have UW Stout. We're very close to the Chippewa Valley Technical Colleges and UW Eau Claire. But you know, increased investment with the K-12s, because you know, working at Chippewa Valley Bean, a high school diploma used to be all you needed. But as things change and as we get more education is always necessary. We want to see a very healthy population. And, that's a big one. You got me kind of stumped there, Kate.
That's sorry. Okay. That's all right. Let's go to Jeff in Delafield. How about? Hi, Jeff. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning. Thank you. Did you have concerns with the amount of irrigation depleting groundwater in the Central Sands? And also, is there a lot of fertilizer that goes into the beans that could contribute to groundwater nitrate issues? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Jeff. Good questions.
So answering that, we're actually funding a study with UW Madison looking at nitrates in beans and what amounts we need versus what amounts we might lose to the soil. So that is a big concern. And we're looking to make sure that we aren't impacting groundwater supplies. As for the amount pumped over there by those guys, that is something I know. We belong to Wisconsin Potato Vegetable Growers, and that is a big topic for those guys. You know, one thing we talk about with agriculture ourselves, and if you talk to many growers of anything around the state, is we want to make sure we leave our land as good, if not better, than we found it. That's really, if you talk to a farmer about sustainability, that's what it is. You know, we want to make sure that land is there for the generations that follow us.
Well, we only have a few seconds left, Charles, but I'm wondering, you're in Germany at this trade fair. What have you learned there about new economic perspectives, business practices?
Well, as of that, nothing right now. We just did our setup today. What okay. I've learned is that they take their COVID hygiene, mask wearing, and everything else much more seriously than we do back home. And, you know, you were seeing here in Germany a lot of the same fears that we see in the United States. You're seeing shipments causing delays or logistics problems, and everybody's a little bit worried about the future and what this is going to bring out.
Charles, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
Appreciate it. Charles Walksmith, Vice President of Chippewa Valley Bean, based in Menominee. Ahead this hour, we look up at the night sky and we anticipate the fall meteor shower season. What would you like to ask the longtime astronomer about viewing meteor showers? 800-642-1234. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with an excerpt from a new book that takes place in an historic hotel.
The Playboy Club Hotel opened in Lake Geneva in 1968. It became a hub for Midwestern travelers, businessmen, and of course, Playboy bunnies. Author Christina Clancy of Madison has just released a novel called Shoulder Season that takes place at the historic resort. She tells the story of fictional 19-year-old Sherry Taylor, who enters a period of self-discovery while working as a bunny. Here's Clancy reading an excerpt from the book. In this scene, Sherry has just begun her job as a bunny, and she learns that the job is a lot different than she imagined.
Sherry began to understand why Gloria, the bunny mother, didn't want to use the word waitress to describe the work the bunnies had to do. What waitress trained for an entire week or stayed up late trying to memorize the contents of two huge binders that were bigger than the Old Testament? Memorization was easier for Sherry than for most of the other girls. She was able to take a mental picture of just about anything she saw and store it in her brain, but still she was overwhelmed by all the rules Bunny Star ticked through. Don't let guests see you wear jewelry, chew gum, eat, or sit. You'll get demerits for having dirt under your nails, if your ears are bent incorrectly, or if you don't keep the changing room cleaned. You need to look at the bulletin board every day for updates and attend bunny council meetings. And don't ever forget to check the ashtrays. Bunny council sounded important. They had their own employee newsletter called the Hare's Head. Wouldn't her friend Jean be impressed to learn that there was more to Sherry's job than strutting around in a bunny suit? Sherry had underlined a line she'd found in the bunny manual twice, once for herself and once for Jean. The bunny has become what the Ziegfeld girl was to another generation, synonymous with the most glamorous young women in the world. She was part of a tradition. She was finally part of something. Sherry even got benefits. She felt like a real adult filling out her forms for accident, life, and health insurance. She had a week's paid vacation and a free subscription to Playboy magazine that she could read 2 weeks before the subscribers. Guests could practically eat for free with Sherry's family discount, but this perk only made Sherry sad that she didn't know anyone who would visit her. Sherry was told she'd be welcome at the Playboy clubs in Chicago and Los Angeles and all over the world. When she heard this, she smiled at Bunny Rhonda. "We should go to Chicago." "That's okay," Rhonda said. "I went there on a school field trip to see the King Tut exhibit. I couldn't stand all the shadows." "The shadows?" "From the skyscrapers. The middle of the day in the city feels like the middle of the night. The L is so loud. I'd be fine if I never went back there again. The loudest thing I hear in Barneveld is a screech owl. That's enough for me." The most important rule, and the one that bothered Sherry the most, was that bunnies were forbidden from dating not just co-workers, but also key holders and guests. The women broke out in a collective groan when they heard this. Now, we're disappointingly moral here, Bunny Star said in a voice that could break up a party. Disappointing was right. Sherry had had a million crushes on the boys at school, and she'd daydreamed about encounters with celebrities like Leif Garrett and Sean Cassidy. Her notebook was filled with the signature combined with the last name of whichever boy she liked at the time. Sherry Parker, Sherry McBride, all with a heart as the dot for the I in Sherry. But aside from Tommy, she'd had little experience. She didn't know how to flirt, much less act sexy. She'd hoped to change all that. Wasn't the resort supposed to be the sexiest place on earth? But with all the rules, she felt like the mystique around Playboy was a total lie. Rhonda seemed relieved, while Sherry felt she'd been betrayed. We may as well have joined a nunnery, she whispered to Bunny Ginger. Don't worry, Ginger winked. I heard there are ways to have fun.
That was author Christina Clancy reading from her new novel, Shoulder Season, which tells the fictionalized tale of working at the once very real Playboy Club Hotel in Lake Geneva. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And now to the night sky and meteor showers. The Draconids are reaching their peak, and the Orionid meteor shower will be at its best later this month. We're learning about the timing, the intensity of these two October meteor showers. With your questions along the way about the night sky, 800-642-1234. Jean Creighton is director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium on the UW-Milwaukee campus. Jean, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Great to be with you.
So how about we do your favorite thing first before we discuss the night sky calendar? If you will, explain to us what is a meteoroid and then what is a meteor shower?
Well, these are the M words, right?
Yes.
So a meteoroid is a term we use for things that are traveling in the void of space. That's how I remember which one is which. And that means we don't have to specify, was this a piece of a comet or a piece of an asteroid? Because it could be either. So these are pieces of debris that are floating through space, and when they hit our atmosphere and make the air around them glow, we call them meteors. We also say shooting stars, falling stars, that's all the same thing. If something hits the ground and we might pick it up, we call it a meteorite. Now, you asked me about meteor showers. We get meteors all the time, a few an hour on average if you're in a dark spot. But sometimes we get many more because the Earth crosses the path of a comet. And then we can predict. We know, oh, there's going to be more debris, and therefore there'll be more meteors, and they tend to come from the same direction in the sky.
Is this how you call them warm leftovers?
Yes, warm leftovers because both asteroids and comets are leftovers from when the solar system was forming. So the warm leftovers are asteroids because they're closer to the sun and they're rocky. And the frozen leftovers, the cold stuff, is comets that are much farther from the sun.
And certainly, I would also carry water or help us with water.
Yes, so comets might have even brought not only some of the water on our planet, but possibly even the first kind of specks of life.
The average asteroid, you've said, has the mass of a grain of rice? How on earth can we see it then?
Hold on. The average the piece of debris. So the
okay, the piece of,
the,
right.
Yep, those tend to be little things, right, like grains of rice or peas. Asteroids, of course, what gives birth to these itty-bitty little things are bigger than
Much
that.
Much bigger.
They can be, yeah, many miles across.
Okay, so this weekend's viewing of the Draconids meteor shower, can you give us what we should anticipate? What should we look for?
Sure. So this particular meteor shower is emanating, if you will, from the Draco constellation. Most of these meteor showers get their name from the constellation that they seem to come from.
Mm-hmm.
This is a constellation that's in the north. and it kind of hovers between the Big and the Little Dipper. Do you think it would be useful to remind people what to look for the Big and the Little Dipper?
Yes, yes,
oh,
please.
Okay, let's do it.
Yeah.
So I like to think of the Big Dipper as a shopping cart with a long, curvy handle. And that's going to be in the northwest. It's fairly low, so if you have a lot of buildings or tall trees in that direction, you might not be able to see it. So try and get yourself, clear horizon along the northwest side of your wherever you're looking at. Now, if you imagine that shopping cart, the two front stars are called the pointer stars. If you extend them about five times, you hit the North Star. So the dragon's tail travels between the pointer stars and the North Star, wraps around the Little Dipper, which also looks like a shopping cart with a long, curvy handle, smaller, of course, than the Big Dipper. And then we see a loop-de-loop and a head. Now, you may or may not see all of what I'm describing, especially if you're in the city. If you're not away from city lights, it might be hard to see even the Little Dipper. But what you can use as kind of your guideline is the North Star. There's a super bright star closer to the horizon called Arcturus that looks like an airplane. It's so bright. And there's also another star called Vega. The area of interest is between those three bright stars that I mentioned, Vega, Arcturus, and the North Star.
Gotcha. So we kind of have our coordinates, if you will. Draconid, this meteor shower, sometimes it's great and sometimes it's not, I understand.
That is true for all meteor showers, to be perfectly candid, so I don't want to set up our listeners for disappointment. As far as I'm concerned, if you see between 5 and 10 an hour, that's pretty good. That's not to write home about, I understand. But the thrill of seeing something that's traveled through space, in some cases for years, hitting the top of our atmosphere and saying hello to you should be a wonderful experience. I would advise to bring something comfortable a lawn chair is perfect because you can look up. You want to find an area with as big a horizon as you can manage it, because nicely, they're not limited only to that area of sky that I suggested you find, but you get big streaks that can cover large swaths of the sky.
And I understand that, you know, usually it's right after midnight or so that is a best viewing option, but this meteor shower would be earlier, maybe perhaps in the evening hours.
Which makes it sweeter, right?
Yes, especially for the kiddos.
That's right. You don't have to wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning. Most of us working folks can't really do that. But this one is visible just right, after sunset. So when it's nice and dark, that is when it's best, and that is unusual. So that makes this particular meteor shower, I think, even more friendly to most of us.
We're discussing the slate of fall meteor showers with Jean Creighton, the head of the Manfred Olson Planetarium at UW-Milwaukee. You can join in. Are you excited about the fall season for meteor showers? Are you a watcher, a stargazer? Where do you observe the night sky? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with astronomer Jean Creighton here on the Ideas Network. We're maximizing our viewing of meteor showers, finding out what to expect from the night skies here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We've been talking about the Draconids meteor shower appears every October, and unlike most meteor showers, it occurs earlier in the night. It makes it easier for the kiddos to appreciate shooting stars across the sky. Still time for your meteor and constellation questions with longtime astronomer Jean Creighton of UW-Milwaukee. We're at 800-642-1234. Jean with us for about 9 more minutes. So, besides the Draconids, what other meteor showers might be able to catch this fall and into the winter?
The Orionids are going to peak around the 21st of October. And the other famous one is the Leonids that peak mid-November. By the time we hit the Geminids, even though they're quite good, they peak from the 13th to the 14th of December. And at that point, the weather has become not only unpredictable in terms of whether, whether we have precipitation or not, but it's also usually cold enough that you really don't want to be sitting around for extended periods of time in the night sky. But for right now, if you think about it, the nature is giving us relatively manageable warm evenings. You might, as you wait for the dark to settle, you can enjoy the beautiful fall colors. So you get nature in all its glory, both on Earth and in the sky.
And I know you're kind of partial to the Orionids. Where do you put the stress on that one? Orionids? Orionids?
Well, I would say Orionids, but
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you see, I speak Greek, right? So I'm thinking of Orionas. I'm thinking of the constellation. So in addition to the cool meteor showers that, they are unpredictable, so they deliver small or big, and that depends on many things, there are two things you can count on, and that is two planets. Beautiful. Jupiter and Saturn are going to be visible in the southwest, nice and bright and high. Jupiter is going to be the much brighter of the two. I like to say that if you see an airplane that's moving, that is an airplane. If you see an airplane that's still, that's Jupiter. Jupiter is going to be much brighter than Saturn. And if you have even a modest pair of binoculars or a small telescope, it's possible to see the moons of Jupiter.
All right. So, binoculars or the naked eye, we can see some things.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the moon is kind to us today because it's going to set relatively early in the evening. I mean, it's a crescent. It's beautiful to behold in any case, but it also will set so it won't interfere with your shower viewing.
So does the speed of the meteorite matter to our ability to actually observe it?
Not really. No,
okay.
These guys, you'll see a flash of light. If the original debris, we talked about how typically they're like, as you say, grains of rice. But if there's something like a size of an orange, then you get what's called a fireball. And that can, I've seen a few of those, and they're really pretty because they last more than just a couple seconds. They linger in because they're big enough that it takes longer for the debris to disintegrate as it enters the atmosphere. Those are pretty cool.
Oh, I love the analogy to oranges because, just think about how tiny and momentary that is that we see that meteor and that's a fireball.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm wondering, too, and I know you often get asked this question, but since we're here, how big was the meteor that killed the dinosaurs?
Oh, much, much bigger. so that would have been, the crater that made it is miles across, right?
Mm-hmm.
We think it's off the Yucatan Peninsula. That would have been more than half a mile across. So that is a whole nother level. Happily, we don't get those too often because, that definitely is a problem for us.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to end on a sour note, but let me just say that we are, in fact, tracking anything of that size. So there are about 8,000 objects that we're tracking just because they have the capacity of threatening life on Earth as we know it. And the hope is that we understand how things move, and if there's anything that gets too close to the Earth, we're exploring options of what we would do about it. And one of the ideas we have is to alter their orbits so that they miss the Earth by thousands of miles.
Ah, ah. We're talking with Gene Creighton, who is director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium on the UW-Milwaukee campus. Appreciating astronomy with your questions, 800-642-1234. We heard from Sharon in Lac des Flambeaux, called in, couldn't stay with us. And Sharon was in Georgia and saw a giant meteor during the day and wonders, how big does a meteor have to be seen during the day?
It could, you know, it doesn't have to be all that big. It could be literally the size of an orange or a little bigger. It doesn't have to be that big because that can outshine the moon. These fireballs, in some definitions, a fireball is by definition something that's brighter than the moon. You would see that during the day if you're looking in the right direction.
Yeah. Can you see meteors on a regular night if the sky is clear and dark?
Yes, you can. Yeah. So we have just random debris all the time hitting the atmosphere. What makes meteor showers special is that usually they're more than average. So typical, you'll get 5 an hour anyway. But the nice also thing is that they're concentrated in a particular part of the sky, or they seem to radiate from a particular part of the sky rather than just being any place at, you know, kind of randomly distributed all across the sky.
Yeah, because having a little bit of anticipation, knowing where to look and when to look is certainly helpful. You know, the pandemic has really been difficult for planetariums around the state, around the country, and you're back open. What kind of events are you hosting? How are you doing this?
We're having still a mix of virtual and live programming. You're right, it has been difficult. On the plus side, I realize that there really is value in offering virtual programming because a lot of the people who join us may not be able to travel or live out of state, so they couldn't come this far or even off the continent. So that's been fun to offer programming that's really accessible to a very large audience. After all, I couldn't have 10,000 people join me for anything in a planetarium that fits 75 people. But it is, of course, absolutely marvelous to have live programming again. We had Salsa Dancing Under the Stars last Friday, and that was live. And we had Salsa Lessons just in order to honor Hispanic Heritage Month. And to continue that theme, we have Cultural Celestiales program about the connections between cultures in South America and Central America with the sky. Mm. So, for example, today we have a program on Peru. Next week we'll have a program on Brazil. And the nice thing about a virtual program is that our speakers can be elsewhere. Our Brazilian is going to join us from Brazil. We have a program also on Chile and Puerto Rico.
Oh, Gene, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. What a pleasure to talk about the beautiful sky with you today.
I appreciate it. Gene Creighton, director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium on the UW-Milwaukee campus. Stay with us for a conversation about cybersecurity, ransomware attacks, and what can be done about a staffing shortage in the field, as well as a brush up on our own password hygiene. Have you changed your passwords, by the way? I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.